All museum curators want people to come, to tour, and learn from their exhibits. Michael Lewick Trams is taking his latest exhibit to the people on a modified school bus. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Michael Lewick Trams of the Traces Center for History and Culture based in Mason City. His latest project is At Home in the Heartland, How Midwesterners Got to Be Us. I'll talk with him about how the Midwest developed differently from other regions in the United States and about how Iowa's culture differs from that of our neighbors. We'll dig into Iowa history and questions of identity. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Good morning. This hour, we're going to talk about what makes Iowa, Iowa, and how we got to be us. Those are questions that Michael Lewick Trams of the Traces Center for History and Culture, based in Mason City, set out to answer. His latest project is At Home in the Heartland, How Midwesterners Got to Be Us. And he'll be setting out in a modified school bus to take his exhibit all over Iowa Friday of this week, and he is with me today. Hello, Michael.
Thank you so much, Charity. Hello.
Oh, thank you for being here. And I know this is not your first trip out with the Busseum, but tell me what it was about our identity as Iowans that made you want to start this journey.
Indeed, this is not the first bus tour. Our organization, the Traces Center for History and Culture, began sending our buses out across the state, across the region in 2005. What was interesting for us as docents, as people who guided the exhibit, was when we went to the different 12 Midwest states, we realized, oh, people in Missouri are different from Iowans in some key ways, and we're different from Minnesotans, where I've also lived for 10 years. And we noticed that even within the Midwest, there were differences. What were those differences? And that, of course, began balls rolling. And here we are with a new exhibit, not focused on World War II like in the past, but rather the past as a roadmap to the present and the future.
All right. Well, let's go back in time then to when the identity that we know as Iowa today began to be shaped, because, of course, there were people living here before the settlers came to Iowa. But it is that post-settlement identity that has really shaped where we are today. When Iowa was opened up for settlement, what made this land different, that attracted maybe a different groups of people?
Well, of course, further east, people assumed that where there were trees, the land was more verdant and more farmable. And for a long time, people talked about the land west of the Mississippi, where there were no trees, as the Great American Desert. They assumed that the lack of trees meant the lack of fertility, the lack of moisture, which, of course, we know isn't the truth, at least from the Mississippi till about Lincoln, Nebraska. And in fact, once they realized, that grassland is indeed very rich and a good farm area, then things changed.
And those first settlers that came to Iowa, a lot of them tended to be from Germany or other close by European countries. Why was that?
Right. Of course, the very first people who came from Europe would have been the French, Marquette and Joulet, who came in 1673. Explorers, Marquette was a padre, was a religious man looking for converts. Joulet was looking for trade routes. 115 years later, Julien de Butte came and was looking for lead mines. By 1810, there were European outposts along the Mississippi and even a few along the Missouri looking for furs to trade with the Indians. It was as of the 1803 purchase by the United States of what was then, again, French territory, Louisiana, that we can really talk about American settlement. When the first people came in the 1830s to survey in the 1840s, they found this huge open space. The Iowa River was the sort of center axis of that universe. The Des Moines River was almost on the edge of the world for them, and that's one of the ways we got our name, and I can talk about that later. So these people were right away concerned with the business of drying up the land. The first people who came who were not surveyors or trappers, the first settlers, were mostly from New England and from the Ohio River Basin. Of course, many of the people in the Ohio River Basin had come from New England or upstate New York, Pennsylvania, but there's a big distinction between those who came from classical New England in the Ohio River area. They opened the territory, they named it, they divided it up into counties, into townships. It was at that point that the first Germans came in large numbers. They came about the same time that in Germany a failed revolution would have made Germanic areas democratic. And so some of the biggest idealists, Karl Schurz and others who fled the king's wrath, they came to places like Wisconsin, Missouri, and Iowa, and that left a deep impact.
Tell me a little bit about the impact that that did leave, because so these were people who had very strong political views and were looking for freedom and were looking for land. That must have shaped Iowa as we put in our political structures.
Indeed. Let's differentiate, though, that there really was no Germany as such when most of our people who now live in Iowa of German descent, when they left Europe and came to this continent, they didn't leave a Germany. Germany only exists since 1871, and most of our people here by then, they came from Prussia, which is basically Berlin and points eastward and along the Rhine. They came from Württemberg, which would be Stuttgart area. They came from Brandenburg, Saxon, where I have been living in Dresden. So when they came as Württemberger and Prussians and others, they had known the rule of kings. Some of the kings were benevolent, but many of them were not. The kings could basically arbitrarily declare, you will be in my cavalry and you will pay these taxes and you will do this and you do that. And people got tired of that, of course. In places like Swabia, Württemberg, where the Lueks, my dad's people, come from, there had been hunger. There had been crop failures. There had been wars. Somehow the Saxons and the Württemberg king backed Napoleon just as he was losing all of his battles. So people like the Lueks left. To come to a place where they could be their own kings, basically.
They made their way to Iowa. There were other Western European or Northern European settlers who also made their way to Iowa. Many Norwegians came to Iowa. That's something that a lot of people can identify with. Swedish settlers as well. Was there a lot of mixing among these different groups in early Iowa, or did people pretty much keep to themselves?
I grew up on a farm between Mason City and Clear Lake. My mother's people were three quarters German, one quarter not German American. My dad's people were the opposite, one quarter German. And I remember my parents talking that when they were kids, a mixed marriage wasn't between a black and a white person, but rather a Norwegian Lutheran and a German Catholic. What I should mention is that today, something like 37% of all Iowans have Germanic heritage, or at least they claim not in the census. Other groups are either smaller than that number or much smaller. People say that, you know, they're of English descent or of Danish or whatever. Groups like the Danes mixed in quicker and disappeared faster. Yes, of course, our friends out of Elkhorn would beg to differ, but they came in smaller numbers than the Germans, and they tended to live in pockets. And that Scandinavian culture got absorbed faster. If you go to Wikipedia, our professor, you can find out a lot about these different groups. The Germans, I think, because of their numbers, were able to sustain Germanic institutions longer. German language newspapers, German language sermons. There were also Turnvereine, so these sports clubs. I think Davenport had those as well. Biergarten, which the Prohibition Act helped knock on the head. So the Germans lasted longer as an identifiable group until World War I.
Now, of course, when World War I came along, there was a lot of anti-German sentiment in the United States. How did that play out in Iowa?
Well, what's interesting, our whole project is a nonprofit, money-losing organization. We are nonpartisan. It doesn't mean that we're not political. And one of the things that we hope to help people learn our bus is how do politics act out, play out on the street? The word politics comes from the Greek polis, meaning city, and it comes to the idea that politics are how you move in the city. Well, of course, we don't live in Sparta or ancient Athens. We live in a state, in counties and cities. How do people move here? And in World War I, the Anglo-Saxon Americans were quite happy to use World War I as a premise to, quote, dehyphenate Americans. We have to remember we were much closer to the point of immigration. So you had Hungarian Americans, you had Polish Americans, you had all the other different hyphen Americans. And so they pushed that the Germans would also be Anglified, but there were, of course, different considerations. The Germans were thriving in the Midwest. There were Germanic cities like Milwaukee, St. Louis, Cincinnati, even Louisville, Kentucky. St. Paul, Minnesota was quite German. Des Moines had a big German population. And by this point, 19-teens, they were thriving. They had breweries. Some of the early car manufacturers were German American driven, and they were doing well. And I think East Coast elites who were not Germanic were only too happy to sort of knock those people on the head and sort of push the Anglo weight around.
Now, in Iowa, there were so many Germans. Did the German culture survive in a stronger way here because there were just so many?
That's a good question. In the third book of the trilogy, I've just finished writing about my dad's people. The Littlewicks have been in Michigan for 20 years around Ann Arbor. They came in the 1830s and moved on to Iowa in the 1850s. In Ann Arbor, there really were pockets of what we call Klein Deutschland, Little Germany. And as I said, German language, sermons, newspapers, sports clubs, singing groups. When they got to Iowa, and my people, the Littlewicks, went out to north central Iowa and it was really prairie, it was the 1850s, they couldn't sustain that. So the German things they had done in Michigan, for example, eating dark grain bread or sauerkraut, drinking lots of beer, those things were harder to sustain when they got out here where basically they had to shoot buffalo and elk to live and there weren't beer cannon around to go to. They had to eat ground corn and cornbread, and they did very un-German things.
Looking around the other states around Iowa, that's part of what you're focusing on is not just the Midwestern identity, but the Iowa identity. Again, was it the concentration of Germans in this state that sort of set us apart, even from, let's say, Nebraska or South Dakota?
I should back up a little bit on something you asked about, you know, what's the significance of the German heritage. We have to look at what kind of Germans were coming when, because they differed. If you go up to Wellsburg, Iowa, and that region, we'll be showing our bus there around October 3rd during the German festival. Those were Frisians. They came from the north. They were what's in Germany called Fischköpfe, fish heads. They were more peasants, wooden shoes, speaking Plattdeutsch. Other Germans, like my dad's people, Swabians, were from further south, maybe a little more robust, a different culture. So each kind of German brought their own twist to the mix, plus when they came was decisive. So different people fled Europe at different points from the same cultural areas for different reasons. Again, either there was a war they were trying to escape, conscription, forced servitude. They were escaping hunger. Another time they might be escaping economic bust. So when these people came to Iowa, the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, slavery was the issue tearing apart American society as a whole. And the German immigrants who had just had an attempted revolution in the 1840s, they were all about individuals making their own decisions, autonomy, and the last thing that Germans were going to support here was slavery. One of the reasons that Iowa fought more in the Civil War per capita than any other state was that we had this strong anti-slavery assumption.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to historian Michael Lewick Trams of the Traces Center for History and Culture based in Mason City. He's just about to set off with his latest project, At Home in the Heartland, How Midwesterners Got to Be Us, with his bus Zeum. He's leaving on his tour on Friday. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with historian Michael Lewick Trams of the Traces Center for History and Culture based in Mason City. He has just put together a new exhibit called At Home in the Heartland, How Midwesterners Got to Be Us. And this hour, we're talking about Iowa history. We're talking about Iowa identity. He's just about to set off in a modified school bus, a bus Zeum, to take this exhibit all over the state of Iowa, starting in Belmont on Friday. We'd love to hear from you as well this hour. When you think about what it means to be Iowan, what are your answers? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, we were talking about how we have so many Germans that settled in Iowa and how that sort of shaped our culture. And the Germans were absorbed less quickly into sort of this universal culture in Iowa than some of the other groups that came in smaller numbers. When you look at culture that sort of survived in Iowa, what do you see from this early German settlement that still remains a part of our culture today?
When I was a teenager, I was lucky enough to get a Rotary scholarship to live in England for a year. And so I got to know England as a young man and was impressed by it. But having lived in Germany now 12 years on and off, I see differences between the different European countries and their respective cultures. And of course, within a country, the Northern English, the Yorkshire people are different than Southern English, the Northern Germans are different than the Southern Germans, et cetera, et cetera. What I see in Germany to this day is an assumption of egalitarianism, that even though the Germans also had kings and lords and knights, that social division is not as strong as places like England or maybe as consciously aware as in France or other places. So my impression is this: for many years, decades, certainly maybe centuries, for some reason, and there are probably explanations for it, that Germanic people tend to be more egalitarianism. When, again, I've said it before the break, that when the Germans came to Iowa in the 1840s, 50s onward, they were so committed, no slavery, but their sense of fair play went further. We know that one of the first legal questions at the Iowa Supreme Court settled in 1839 was, would there be slavery? No, Iowa would be a free state. In 1884, the Iowa legislature passed a law there'd be no segregation. Again and again, there are so many examples. George Washington Carver was our state-supported scientist at what became Iowa State University doing his phenomenal research. This was not possible in Missouri. In fact, there's a beloved story that one of my friends tells from the Cedar County Historical Society in Tipton, Iowa, Sandy Harmel, that as I remember her story, there was a group of businessmen in Tipton who in the 1800s supported a local African-American young man to come to the university in Iowa City. He joined the basketball team. I suppose they thought there'd be some glory for Tipton through this. Well, he was so good at it that when the then, when what's now U of I basketball team went to Missouri, the Missouri college team saw this African-American young man and said, oh, if he plays with you, we won't play you. And they said to them, the Missourians, if he doesn't play, we won't play you. And I'm really quite proud of this sense of decency and egalitarianism. I think Iowans, by and large, are very fair and decent people. I would not say that Iowans strike me as a particularly racist or arrogant or classist people. Not everyone around the world is like that.
Now, of course, Iowans love to talk about our progressive past. That's something that it makes a lot of us feel very proud to be from Iowa. But we are not a perfect people. And, of course, bad things happened here as well. And a lot of people, even today, will say if they move into an area of rural Iowa that it's very hard to be an outsider. No matter what ethnicity you are, it's just hard to become part of a community. Is that a significant part of our culture as well, that it's difficult to integrate into Iowa?
It is. Of course, every culture, every group has a horizontal line and a vertical line. I'm generalizing. Again, I have a personal desire to see Iowa in a good light, but it's not always so easy. An example that I took about 10 years ago a group of people to Western Iowa to start an organic gardening farming alternative energy project. And we were in a edge of a town of 75 people. And I remember the outrageous rumors that were flying around that we were Muslims. Well, I'm not a Muslim. That my dad was a Des Moines banker. My father was dead by that point. And that one of our board members was my lover. She was actually my former high school English teacher. So, you know, in small towns around the world, I've lived in small towns in Germany. I've stayed longer in South American small towns, other places. People need something to talk about. And the wilder the story, the more interesting the twiddle-twaddle. So this is a problem. I know that in Germany, there are rural areas of the former Eastern Germany that are depopulating, Sachsen, Sachsen-Anhalt, Thuringen, and they have a huge problem that they don't have enough people to man the factories, to take up jobs, clean the streets, repairing houses. And so they need people to come, but they don't want non-Germans. And I was just in Decorah for the weekend visiting friends of mine, giving a program about the current refugee crisis in Germany. And we talked about Postville. I don't know enough about it to speak really authoritatively on it, but I am intrigued. You know, if Postville was an early test plot for rural Iowa, how can we integrate people significantly different from the mainstream? How will that play out? And I know that I and my colleagues at Traces in Western Iowa, we didn't have an easy time of it.
And, of course, there are many communities in Iowa right now that have very, very different ethnic makeup than they would have had historically, and some communities are thriving and others are not dealing with it so well. Let's go to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. My guest this hour is Michael Lewick-Trams, historian with the Traces Center for History and Culture based in Mason City. His latest project is At Home in the Heartland, How Midwesterners Got to Be Us. And we want to hear your thoughts about what it means to be an Iowan. 866-780-9100. Stacy's on the line from Washington. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
My question is, well, I am a senior at the University of Iowa working on an honors thesis, and its basis is very close to this conversation. I am working on anti-German sentiment and differences of those feelings between Davenport and Burlington, Iowa. In an earlier class, I discovered that Davenport had an overabundance of anti-German sentiment reported in the media, et cetera, while Burlington had a lack of. And I'm wondering what the speaker thinks that might be the cause. And I'll take my answer off the air. And thank you.
All right, Stacy, thanks a lot for your call. So in different communities in Iowa responding in different ways, I'm sure during World War I and World War II, with anti-German sentiment.
Mm-hmm. I've alluded to this answer actually already. I'm not a Marxist, I never have been, but Marxism is an interesting tool. And one of the things that Marx said was that most issues come down to an economic core motivator, and I think that's really true. So maybe I don't know Burlington well enough. I've been there a couple times, but I don't know the town that well. Perhaps the different ethnic groups lived together more peaceably. I know that there was a large German-American group in Davenport. Again, we'll be showing the bus in Davenport at the German-American Heritage Center, and they can tell more about this. But who knows? I would guess that there were economic interests fanning some of these intra-group resentments and conflicts. We can look to Zimbabwe, we can look to Serbia, we can look to Northern Ireland, we can look to anywhere where groups of people have not been always living together well or harmoniously, and often find an economic motive. Who owns the plantations? Who has the most money? Who has the most privilege? Unfortunately, these are the human old conflicts. Different groups of people want to compete for space, for resources, for prestige. I don't know what was going on in Davenport, but that's my best guess. There were probably some vested interest that thought if we can sort of knock the German-American contingent on the head, there'll be, quote, more glory for us.
Well, and during that time, whether there was anti-German sentiment that played out in a real way or not, I would guess that a lot of Germans wanted to not talk about their Germanic heritage at that time. My ancestors lived in Ogden, Iowa. My great-grandfather owned the grocery store, and his first name was Detlef. And with World War One, he went by D. Nebbe instead of Detlef Nebbe. Yeah. I'm sure that there are, and I don't, of course, I don't know the exact history behind that, but I'm sure that there are a lot of people who just wanted to downplay their cultural connections because they were Americans and because they were Iowans.
I can say, as someone who's basically emigrated to Germany, what it's like to live in a culture that's not your native-born one. One wants to fit in. I mean, when we go to junior high or high school, we want to fit into our age group. People want to fit in almost everywhere they go. It's a natural human reflex. Imagine the other direction. If you come from Europe to Iowa in the 1800s and you settle, you establish a business, a farm or whatever, and then a war breaks out with the country that you came from. You know, you're in a sort of a pickle. You have to pick loyalties, or at least publicly. We know that even World War II, that there were rumors that German Americans were not fully loyal, although the point of immigration had been 50 or even 100 years earlier. When we took our
And of course, we saw that play out with Japanese Americans as well during World War II. Both Germans and Japanese Americans, their loyalty was questioned.
What's interesting, there were 15,000 German Americans who were imprisoned, like the Japanese Americans, that no one talks about. And it's very odd. I've been to some of the camps in Texas and other places. For some reason, even that experience has been erased, that German-American civilians were also interned, women, children, men. It's such a taboo that they're even forgotten from that sub-story.
Very interesting. And let's go back to the phones. John is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I own an older home in the northern part of Iowa City, and I was doing some work on it, and a piece of newspaper fell out, and it was in German. And I went down to the Historical Society and talked to them, and they said, yes, that there was a German language newspaper in Iowa City. And, you know, you're aware of the fact that there was a lot of Czechs and Bohemians in Iowa City, but I didn't realize there was enough of a German population to support a German language newspaper.
Up until 1914, there were over 1,000 German language newspapers in the United States. There were hundreds of German language Vereine, so associations, sports groups, singing clubs, etc. They disappeared pretty quickly. The U.S. government was clever enough, they didn't outlaw German language newspapers outright. However, they enacted legislation and regulations that German language papers had to be sent to Washington to be censored and then returned to the editor to be published. Well, who was going to invest money in weeks or even months old news? So, of course, most of those papers died out.
John, thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Julius is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Julius.
Yes, hello. How are you doing?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I heard your last comments, and I like the idea of erasing the hyphenation of Americans, but I don't think that translates very well with other nationalities, as in Asian Americans, African Americans, and so forth. So I was wondering, why did African Americans they tunneled and went straight to Chicago or even Detroit? And I mean, did some of those African Americans settle in Iowa? And even on top of that, when it comes to other nationalities, where did Iowa play into portaling in those minorities or ethnicities into Iowa's culture?
Okay, Julius, thanks a lot for your call. So I think Julius is asking about with the Great Northern Migration, when many African Americans left the South and traveled north, why not Iowa?
Actually, if you go again to Professorpedia and Google Red Summer 1919, unfortunately, there was a disastrous summer of 1919 when many American soldiers were coming back from the European battlefields. And in their absence, African-American men and some women, I suppose, had been recruited from the South and brought to Chicago, Detroit, Indianapolis, I suppose somewhat Des Moines, but Omaha to work in the stockyards. And there was a horrific story of a lynching of a man named Will Brown, who was accused by a German-American young woman, Agnes, I've forgotten her last name. Anyway, he was taken to the Douglas County Courthouse downtown. The building still stands. And a mob broke out. The mob stormed the building, set it on fire, chased the sheriff and the other inmates to the top of the roof. The mayor came. They hung him up by the lamppost. He went unconscious. He almost died. He was then rescued by a sheriff. I mean, there was just a hysteria that even in our beloved Midwest in that period that had racial lines. I should mention here that I have always felt that Iowa was a fair and decent place. My mother's people had African-American friends. My mom went to summer camp, a Methodist church camp in Clear Lake, and boarded with Cynthia Martin. Her father was my grandmother's foot doctor, and my mother was racial blind. I still want to believe that she doesn't really see people's color. My dad's people, on the other hand, farmers from further south in northern Iowa, they did not know any African-Americans, and my great-grandfather in the 1920s was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So I grew up in this schizoid family that my mother's people really didn't seem to care what color people were. And my father's people did take notice, although they were old school Democrats and my mom's people Republicans. So all these loyalties and lines sort of fade and get jumbled. It comes down to how do we treat each other in person across the store counter or in the doctor's office. And this is one of the questions we look at in our exhibit.
Thanks so much for your call. What an interesting question. And Mark is on the line next in Marshalltown. And this is actually Mark Smith of the Iowa House. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for my call. I had a couple of questions. First one is that our guest today seems to be speaking English with a German cadence. And I wanted to know if other people have thought that as well. The second question I have, and I'm sure that his book addresses a lot of this issue, but I've said for quite a while that I feel like Iowa gets its language from England and its culture from Germany. So would you talk about those two things?
Well, sure. Mark, thanks a lot for your call. And of course, you've spent many years living in Germany. So
yes.
That
if the listeners could see it, I'm sort of blushing at the moment, sort of caught off guard. Indeed, I lived in England for a year when I was a teenager. I went to a boys' school in Yorkshire. Again, that was the compliments of the Rotary Club. I lived in Czechoslovakia. One of the best things that George Bush Sr. ever did in his career, as far as I'm concerned, was send me for 2 years at the Peace Corps to teach at a university on the Czech-Polish border. And I have lived in Germany about 12 years. I did my doctoral work. And when you live in a place long enough, speech patterns bleed and absorb. The Germans have this folklore they like to tell. I don't know if it's accurate. They say, oh, well, you in America, there was a vote that German was almost official language. I don't think that can be accurate. I don't think the early founding fathers, if there were any mothers, but those founders were all very much Anglos. What I can believe is they're mixing up something maybe in Pennsylvania. The Quakers, I became a Quaker when I was 17, just to be transparent. Perhaps the Quakers said, we have a lot of Mennonites out west of Philly in Lancaster. Maybe they talked about having bilingualism or maybe German in the colony of Pennsylvania. I don't know. But indeed, the English colonies were always solidly Anglo-identified. Think about this, though, that our people coming from Denmark or France or Germany, wherever, they spoke those languages for 10 or more thousand years. We've been speaking English for 100, 150. I'm very bad at languages, but I picked up German very quickly.
We're going to have to take a break.
And
we'll get back
genetic.
To this in a moment. So we'll talk more in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Michael Lewick-Trams of the Traces Center for History and Culture. It's based in Mason City, and his latest project is At Home in the Heartland, How Midwesterners Got to Be Us. He's developed an exhibit that is aboard his busium, and he's setting off on a tour of the state beginning in Belmont on Friday. And we've been talking all hour about some of the, particularly the Germanic influences in Iowa and how Iowa developed an identity. When I, in my life, have traveled to other states, and I've lived in a couple of other states, just purely anecdotally, I feel like the identity in Iowa, the sort of patriotism in Iowa, is stronger than it is in many other places. Is that something that you feel too, Michael?
When I grew up in northern Iowa on the farm, I left high school with the feeling that everyone was white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. It was a revelation to me to find out there were people in America who weren't white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. It was like, oh, we're not alone here. So the quote, white nation that I grew up in was in many ways a fallacy then, but it's certainly a fallacy now. America, it has changed a lot in the last 50 years. I'll be 53 December, so my context is half a century. America's changing. Iowa's changing. One of the beauties of this exhibit that we're taking out is that its predecessors were all about Iowa or the Midwest and World War II. Our encounters with Germans or Austrians between 1933 and 48. This exhibit, unlike those, looks at the past as a roadmap, how we got to where we are, but it also considers the present and it looks at the future. And so these are open questions. We don't have all the answers in our bus, but we have a lot of the right questions, and we're also inviting dialogue.
So when people visit your bus, what do they see?
Well, in the bus itself, there are 18 panels. There are 10 interior panels that break down into two topics each. The role of ethnic groups in Iowa settlement. We look at the role of religion, the topic of self-governance. We look at communication, transportation, work, leisure, education, the roles of families in the past. The external panels are more diverse. We have a couple that are collages, the photos of Martin Thoe, who was a Norwegian-American photographer in the northern prairies of Iowa. His photos were amazing, and they're in our exhibit throughout. We have a panel about the German-Americans after World War I, and we talk about exactly this problematic in depth. And the other exterior panels are the Midwest as an overview. Where did the name Iowa come from? Where does Midwest culture come from? Because it's different than the South, and we document that, that it was born on April 7th in 1788 in what's now Marietta, Ohio. We talk about those things. We go in depth.
Now, you talk about where the name Iowa comes from, and that's something that way back when we were in our fifth grade Iowa history lessons, we learned, of course, that Iowa meant the beautiful land, or this is the place. And this is a myth.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, so if that is mythology, what have you uncovered about what our name means and what it means about us?
Well, I'm no linguist either. I'm an academic, and I try to be a scholar. You know, we were told things that were bunk by a rather friendly, nice man. I mean, we all liked Herb Hake's cartoons. But now look at this. 50 years later, we're trying to undo the damage. In our culture, we tell each other things that aren't true. An example, I once was handed a book by one of the sort of leading scholars of German POWs in America, and he had made a typo that Camp Algoma, Idaho, was one of the German POW camps. What was Camp Algona in Iowa? And yet people at academic conferences would say, no, there's no Algona, Iowa. There was Algoma, Idaho. So these errors or these tall tales, they have long lives. So we are about the business as well of saying, as current scholarship suggests, the name comes from native language itself, and it suggests that it comes from, you know, the sleepy ones. Of course, Herb Hake, what he said sounded good, and it was, again, part of the economic boosterism, you know, let's sell Iowa. But those are dangerous jingoisms that we need to watch out for.
This is a question from Cindy in Ames. When I came to Iowa in the 70s, I was amazed by how thoroughly Iowa's tall grass prairie, which had covered 85% of the state, had been obliterated. Then I learned that Iowa has less of its original landscape than any other state. How do you think that has affected Iowa culture and thinking?
One of the things that I write about in my books is that we came to America, we came to the prairie, and we changed the environment, and the environment also changed who we had been. If you take a bunch of Danes and Germans and Irish people and bring them out to the prairies, it's totally different than the coast of Belfast or the foothills of the Swabian Mountains. So the environment is some place that we interact with. I spent quite a bit of time in New Mexico with our other buses, other exhibits, and just that lack of rain and lack of good soil made it for centuries in New Mexico a really harsher life. It affects the social strata. Iowa, up until the last 35 years, was very much a middle-class state where there was relatively low little poverty, and people with a great deal of wealth usually didn't flaunt around. It affected us, and we affected the environment, and we're still in that relationship. We affect the land. It affects us.
Well, and that kind of power that the settlers held over the land and the idea of manifest destiny, I mean, that was incredibly powerful in shaping the Midwest, right?
It was indeed. Most people in most eras believe things they're not aware of are beliefs, and we absorb our beliefs from those people around us, from our parents, from our priests, from our doctors, from today television or the internet. And it's difficult to sort out, you know, what is me, what is innate, and what is what I've assumed. Indeed, when Iowa was settled, we believed that we were bringing civilization. The natives who'd been here for 10,000 years or more were savages. In the books that I've just been publishing, it's called Oceans of Darkness, Oceans of Light, a pentology. I've got the first three done, and you can get them on Amazon, Roots of Darkness. That's volume number one. I talk about how these assumptions that we were coming to the Midwest to build a new Canaan, at least the way that I grew up, a rather middle-of-the-road Protestant background, there was still this assumption of sort of American exceptionalism, that we were the chosen people, that we were here. You know, God had brought us somehow to the Iowa prairies. If you read in book three, which we publish soon, there was a speech in the 50s in Belmont by a local historian who talked about, you know, in Belmont, the prairie was flourishing and the sky was clear, just waiting for the human eye to fall upon it. And I'm thinking, well, there were Native American human eyes.
Plenty of humans here, right?
You know, so we make these assumptions that we need to question, and I'm hoping that's part of what our exhibit will do.
Well, and it's interesting how looking at history over time, you know, we look with our modern moral compass, and you know, I've heard people even criticize, for example, the books of Laura Ingalls Wilder as being racist against Native Americans, and I mean racism of that kind was rampant and accepted among the settlers at that time.
Of course, we have to be careful with all these terms. I mean, I was accused in Grinnell, Iowa, of being a racist, and that followed me for a long time, and it was totally unfactual. What is a racist? What are racist thoughts? We all have thoughts. We notice someone going on the street who looks different than us. Oh, that's a person different than me. It depends what we make out of that difference.
But when we look at history and we try to impose our modern moral compass on history, it strikes me that if we throw something out because we feel like this bias is immoral, aren't we missing some of the things that we can learn from that history?
Well, I think what's really important is to step away from ideology. We have the idea of a thing, and we have the way the thing really is. And I think for me, one of the starting points is to acknowledge what is in each of us. As I said 20 minutes ago, my great-grandfather, who I knew and loved, was in the Ku Klux Klan. Okay, I'm not responsible for that, but I have a responsibility going forward to say, you know, let's step away from groups that preach hate and violence. So first, we have to talk about what really was. And Iowa doesn't have a perfectly clear, unblemished past. Let's talk about it. And we're hoping in this exhibit that people come and have discussions, and we want to generate. And there will be people of different opinions, and that's fine, as long as we talk about these differences with respect and an attitude of wanting to learn and have exchange, then we all win.
Let's go back to the phones. Patrick is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, this is Pat DeLuria. I would say a couple of things. One, a phrase that stuck with me all my adult life was, Iowa is a state the way Norway is a nation, which I always meant a lot to me and signified that unity in our state of identity. Second, that if you look at the migration from Europe between 1850 and 1920, much of Europe is represented in Iowa from east to west, from north to south, from Ireland to Italy, from Spain, which is represented by Mexican Americans, all the way to Eastern Europe. And my last would be, you may be aware of this strand of southwest Iowa, which I grew up in Davenport, but I learned later, you know, in the 60s, the Everly Brothers and all of that kind of music that we think of as Missouri and southern sounding music. But the Everly Brothers in the 50s actually came from southwest Iowa. Then they migrated south to do their music, but they came from that strand of Iowa that was two counties wide down in southwest Iowa, which I always found very fascinating and found it working statewide, that you find that strand of southern Iowa spread up along the Missouri River all the way up into Sioux City.
Well, Patrick, I want to return.
That's my comment.
Great. Thank you so much for your call. And I want to return to Patrick's first comment, the idea that Iowa is a state the way that Norway is a nation, which goes back to something that I said earlier. I mean, and we didn't quite get to, do you feel like Iowan identity is stronger than some other states?
I would say so. I've had friends who moved here from the Pacific Northwest, and they said, gosh, I feel like I'm really in America now. We've been a very homogenous group of people the last 150 years. So it's been easy to have an identity of, oh, people who look like me were from one group. If we were in South Central L.A. or we were in Florida or in somewhere else, it'd be different in South Bronx. So in Iowa, it's been easier. Again, that's changing. And I think we need to be open to that change and have a discussion. What does it mean to be an Iowan? Who are we and who have we been? Who could we yet become?
Let's go to Tom in Clear Lake. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I was wondering what's time left if we could address what influence the immigrants had on the labor movement in Iowa or U.S. in general. I mean, it's like the blue laws, I'd always heard that some of the blue laws were passed where they no liquor sales on Sunday because the immigrants gathered in beer gardens and the union organizers were able to get to them there, so they tried to banish that. Is there any truth to that or just in general the influence on organized labor?
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for your call.
I don't know enough about the culture of prohibition and temperance to comment on that. About the labor, of course, I grew up in a rural area, but labor unions are very strong and important in Dubuque, Waterloo, other, quote, blue-collar towns.
Muscatine.
Sioux City, Council Bluffs. That's a history that's fading. In general, I'd like to make a comment that our exhibit and our programming, everywhere we go, there'll be workshops. There'll be presentations. We'll have, in some schools, intergenerational conversations where we're taking senior citizens into schools to talk about their towns in the past. And some evenings we're having public fora at churches, synagogues, or Quaker meetings. But one of the other axes of our program is generational. And there are so many young people who don't know any of these stories. And it's rather sobering for me to think about. There's so many young folks who would have no idea, you know, what would be the labor history of Iowa. They'd have no clue. They could tell you little. And so we want to erode that lack of information and change that conversation field.
Let's get to another phone call. Josh is on the line in Belmont. Hi, Josh.
Howdy.
Hi.
I'm glad that you all are going to come here on Friday. I'm interested to stop out and see the bus. I had a question, though. You've been talking a lot about German immigration, and where I'm from, as you well know, it's pretty heavily Norwegian in this area. And reading about Norwegian history, it seems like it's fairly egalitarian, and, you know, we still kind of have that tradition here of working with each other. I know it's a lot different than, like, in southern Iowa, where it was settled differently, different times. I was just wondering if you could kind of comment on that, if kind of that Nordic influence meant that parts of Iowa were more egalitarian in nature and others were more individualistic.
All right, Josh, thanks a lot for bringing that up.
Indeed, I'm not sure if it's true, but when I was growing up in Sargota County, it was said that the farmers' co-op in Rockwell was the first cooperative, farmers' cooperative in America from the 1870s. I don't know if that's true. It was one of the first large and successful and well-known ones, that's for sure. It also plays a role in my book. If there were Norwegians or other Scandinavians involved in the formation of that co-op, I don't know. My great-grandparents were involved, and they weren't Scandinavian. I do know, however, that in Minnesota and the Dakotas, that Scandinavian immigrants played a large role in forming dairy co-ops, cooperative senior citizen centers like in Decorah. I was there this weekend that a woman gave money for a private charity to house retired Norwegian immigrants. So the Scandinavians were, by and large, very progressive. We can owe a lot of the progressive movements to the Scandinavians who were among us, but they weren't the dominant culture. They always had to interface with the Germans, with the Anglos. And I must say that, you know, the Anglos, we're an English-speaking nation predominantly today. We need to also look that in the face and ask, what was that process that the English always prevailed and pushed themselves over?
We're nearly out of time, but now clearly you enjoy history. You enjoy digging into some of the things that shaped Iowa. But why do you think it's important for someone in 2015 who is an Iowan, maybe grew up here or has become a part of the state, to stop and think, what does that mean to be an Iowan? Why is it important to question the identity?
Well, my people came here 200 years ago, or almost in the 1830s, to Linn County. And I grew up in a very different Iowa in the 60s and 70s and graduated in 81. And the Iowa that I knew has so changed, so faded, has morphed, that I want other Iowans to ask questions, okay, here's who we have been. Who are we now and who do we want to become? Because there will be changes. And the question is not will there be change, but how conscious will it be? And I would like that Iowans talk openly and say, well, let's try to strive in this direction. Let's try to strive in that direction. But let's not just change by default and have to deal with things that are given to us. Let's take our fate in our hand and be citizens, not subjects.
Michael Lewick-Trams, thank you so much for being here today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Lewick-Trams of the Traces Center for History and Culture, based in Mason City. His latest project is At Home in the Heartland, How Midwesterners Got to Be Us. And he's setting out in a modified school bus to take his exhibit all over the state of Iowa. You can find out more about the exhibit. You can also find out about the bus tour. So he may be bringing that bus to a town near you. You can go to the website roots.traces.org. You can also Google search for At Home in the Heartland, and you will find more information about the exhibit. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We love to hear from you. Send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts on things you've heard on the show in the past. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show in the future. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.